Good afternoon. You are listening to Juno Afternoon right here on 104.3 KTOO. The time is 3 o'clock. This is Cheryl Snyder, and I will be your host today. We have a great show today. Three of our guests will be talking about their first Friday art openings. That's Fumi Matsumoto, Kaki Shields, and Davita Steifek-Reiter. We'll also hear from naturalist and author Dave Smith about bear spray, firearms, and making smart choices in bear country. And we'll learn about a special event at Chapel by the Lake that combines pottery, song, and scripture. I'd like to let you know that we have a report of a lost dog out on Back Loop Road. It's a male terrier mix that's black and white and goes by the name of Boyo. If you have seen Boyo running around, you can give us a call and we'll give you the contact information for his owner. The weather forecast for this evening shows that we'll have decreasing clouds with isolated showers in the evening. Areas of fog late, lows around 49 with light winds. And for tomorrow, it's going to be sunny with highs around 67, light winds becoming southwest 10 miles per hour in the afternoon. We're going to go now to National Native News. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. This week, the Native corporation Doyon announced it's building a new North Slope oil drilling rig. As Dan Bross from KUAC in Fairbanks reports, the deal comes as Alaska voters consider repeal of a state tax cut credited with spurring new development.
Doyon will operate the new oil rig on Alaska's North Slope for ConocoPhillips under a five-year extendable lease. At a press conference to announce the deal, Doyon President and CEO Aaron Schutt heralded jobs it will create.
It will employ directly about 80 new people for Doyon Drilling, and salary-wise, that's about $8 million annually.
Schutt said 50% of Doyon jobs are held by Native Corporation shareholders. He described subsidiary Doyon Drilling's new rig as a growth opportunity worth the $100 million investment.
Contracts like these are what we hope for to grow our business long-term with a great client in an environment we know, the North Slope, and have been working in for 30 years.
Schutt ties the new rig deal to an industry-friendly state oil tax regime Alaska voters will consider repealing next month. Referendum supporters call the tax system an industry giveaway, while opponents like Doyon credit it with spurring new development. For National Native News, I'm Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Also in Alaska, Native veterans in Metlakatla will soon be able to get a direct housing loan from the Department of Veterans Affairs. Yvonne Perez is a loan specialist for the VA. She says the loans are meant to help improve the lives of veterans.
This is the very first one that we're going to be signing in Alaska. We are hoping to have more tribal villages and housing authorities have interest and also offering this worthwhile benefit to their Native American veterans.
The program provides loans to finance the purchase, construction, or improvement of homes on federal trust land or to refinance. If the property is not on trust land, the veteran can use a different VA loan. A memorandum of understanding was signed with the Metlakatla tribe this week. Maps with fish mercury advisories in the ceded territories of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota examines hundreds of lakes. As Mike Simonson reports, the latest research has some good and not so good news.
In all, 446 lakes, some with intriguing names like Minnesing, Tenderfoot, and Lost Land, have been tested in recent years by the tribes and Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. Glyphwick environmental biologist Sarah Moses says of those lakes, 324 have been color-coded with walleye eating advisories.
We didn't see a lot of changes. We have almost 450 lakes on the maps, and of those, we only had changes in the color or the consumption advice for 9 different lakes.
4 of those lakes had more mercury in the walleye and 5 had less. She says mercury levels in the Great Lakes region have been declining since the 1970s until recently.
We're seeing this uptick in the fish, so there's something going on perhaps in how mercury's cycling in the environment or how the food webs are working that's causing this increase, but it's not known yet what may be behind it.
But Moses says it's vital to get this information to anglers and especially tribal members.
Eating fish, harvesting fish, sharing fish is all part of their traditional lifeway and their identity, and it's very important to the tribes.
The study is part of a four-year, $450,000 federal Great Lakes Restoration Initiative grant that runs out in October. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson.
An annual run started today on the Red Lake Reservation in Minnesota. The Anishinaabe Run for Sobriety and Health is a 200-mile relay. Organizers are encouraging runners to join at any time during the journey, which goes through Leech Lake and Grand Rapids. The trek ends Saturday on the Fond du Lac Reservation with a powwow celebration. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Good afternoon. You are listening to KTOO in Juneau at 104.3, where the time is 3:05 in the afternoon. This is Cheryl Snyder. I'm your host today for Juneau Afternoon, and joining me in the studio now is Fumi Matsumoto and Kaki Shields. Both are presenting their art this Friday at the Canvas Art Gallery on Seward Street downtown. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you. Hi, thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, so first let's start. You both are showing your art in the same space. Is there a connection between your shows, or what brought the two of you together?
Actually, it was our friendship that brought us together.
Great, so then we'll talk individually about each of what you're going to be presenting on Friday night. Fumi, why don't we start with you? Why don't you describe what you've created for this opening?
Well, these are a collection of recent works that I've been doing. I have been printing linoprint block prints on tea bags, and in past shows I've had a couple of pieces, in this show at the Canvas it's all prints. A lot of times I do mixed media sculpture and whatever, but this time I decided to do all prints, which are hung on the wall, and Khaki's doing 3D sculptural things with her books. So these teabag prints, I've been doing them for a couple of years now, and I have a bunch of new images, mostly birds, animals, whales, and such. But the exciting thing is that before I was using little tiny stamps and doing multiple images on one sheet of, on several sheets of glued teabag paper, but I was able to get a hold of very large blocks and cut them up. So now I was able to actually cut whole images on a larger piece of block. And so instead of printing them many times, I could just print one, or I do a mirror image of a raven and a pygmy owl. So those are two, and they're larger prints this time.
Can you talk a little bit about how you prepare the tea bags for printing?
Well, you drink the tea, and it can be any kind of tea. I have all different kinds of teas that I do like. Some of the ones, my favorites are Earl Grey, and I like the vanilla rooibos, and I like Lady Grey Irish Breakfast. The darker ones like that, the stronger teas, make a really pretty dark paper. The stains, I mean. And then if you get one that's herbal tea or green tea, and also the rooibos tea, it's a lighter paper because the stains don't penetrate as much, except on the square bags, a lot of times the stain migrates to the edges and makes a really neat pattern. So depending on the type of tea, and also circular tea bags, too, which I will glue together, and someone asked me, what glue do you use? Just basic acid-free glue stick. And so I'll take the tea bags, and if you have flow-through tea bags, you can open them up, and they have nice little lines, or you can do the, like I said, the circular or the square, and I glue them together to make a paper that's, depending on the size, 11 by 8 or 16 by, 12 or whatever the size, just all depends on the tea bags that you have. And just after drinking it, just leave it out. Do not put them in plastic or anything because then they start to mold, especially the rice tea and green tea. But if you have the regular black tea, just put them on a rack or leave them in a warm place to thoroughly dry, and then you take the tea out, open up the paper, and that's it. It's pretty basic.
Okay, so you create these sort of tea bag canvases, as it were, and you're now ready to start printing on top of it. Can you describe a little bit about your process of carving the blocks? You said there it's like a rubber block that you're working on?
Traditionally, you know, if people work on with wood blocks on wood or linoleum, which is a lot harder surface, this stuff is more contemporary. It feels like a rubber eraser, and it cuts very easily with linoleum cutting tools, and I only use two blades, a big and a small, and it just is like working through butter. It just is very easy to cut, whereas linoleum you have to prepare, warm up, or it's a little takes more pressure. Same with wood. But this, I'll get an image, and some of the images I get from the photographs that I take of birds and animals, or drawings and things from my sketchbook, and also magazines and other books. But the problem I found with like birding books or whatever, all the animals look pretty stiff. But I look for images that have a lot of movement, and you'll notice if you go down to see the show, the whales or the birds, they're in flight. The one exception that's not an Alaskan animal is my tiger, which is very intricate. I cut every single hair on there with my tool. And that came from a dream that I had. So it's called Tiger Dream.
So, and were you working from your imagination when you created the face of that tiger, or were you working from an image?
Well, I had the image in my mind when I had the dream. It was very, very strong image. But somehow I couldn't get it down on paper. And I had this in my head for about a year or so. And I've been looking at pictures of tigers, photographs, watch videos. It never quite came to me. And then just recently, I just happened to see one in a book. And it was a whole body of the tiger in just kind of drinking water or something like that. But just the eyes and everything, you know, spoke to me. So I just, you know, did some drawings, sketches, and then transferred the sketches onto the rubber and go from there. You cut negatively, and it's also a reversal. So if you have a bird facing one direction, when you print it, it's the opposite direction. And you'll notice that in the raven, mirror ravens. There are two mirror images of ravens and also the pygmy owl. And both the raven and the pygmy owl I saw in town, and I took pictures. The owl was at Auk Rec, and the raven was at Costco parking lot. So, but the images are mostly Alaskan animals because that's what appeals to me.
And so I have another question about the tea bag canvases that you're creating. Mm-hmm. Do you find that there are some types of tea bags where the paper just lends better to what you're trying to do, or is tea bag paper pretty generic?
No, they're really different. If you actually have tea that you drink and you take the tea out and look at it, hold it up to the light, some of them have texture on it. Like maybe that's so that the water flows through when you're, you know, getting a hot cup of tea. And other ones look almost like rice paper, especially the generic Lipton's or, the flow-through tea bags. And they're almost like rice paper. They're not made out of rice when you say rice paper. It's just the Japanese paper, very smooth and translucent. Whereas if you get some of the square ones and the round ones, they're double. And I leave them double. I don't open them up. So depending on the image and what I want to do, I try to select the right tea bags to go with the right image. And you'll notice that, too, if you go into to see the show. Some of my the pieces, the images really are improved by the type of stains that are on the background. You know, like I have Arctic terns and I have a kingfisher, and those have really nice orange edges from square tea bags. So yes, I mean, some tea bags are I wouldn't say better. It's just different depending on what
changes
you want to
do. It a little bit, yeah. Mm-hmm. And how did you start working on tea bags?
Well, I like tea. I mean, I drink tea, and I had I don't know why, but I was saving these tea bags, and I had hundreds of tea bags. And if you'd seen previous shows, I made a kimono, a full-length wearable kimono out of used tea bags.
I have. Did you have that maybe up at the Jack Gallery?
Yes, I did.
Yes. Is it still there?
No, I sold it to a friend.
Oh, wonderful.
But if he said if whenever I want to show it or someone wants to see it, it's available in Juneau. And but I also did a coffee filter kimono, which was also at the Jack. Totally different type of image with it. It was white. I bought fresh Costco coffee filters, and I hand-dyed them in silk. Silk dye, and then I cut those up and sewed them into that too. So, but that was, you know, the tea bag. I just happened to have the tea bags, and I don't know exactly why I started printing on them. I think it was probably because I had different scraps of tea bags around, and then I was doing some teaching with kids at various places, school district, and the canvas, and we did printmaking, and that's how I came across a little rubber stamp thing, and I thought, well, try it on a tea bag, and it turned out so well that that's what I've been doing.
Okay. Well, I've had the privilege to see some of the images of your art. Thank you for sharing those with me, and I know it's going to be a beautiful show. I'm excited for you and definitely encourage people to go down and check it out. So, Khaki, let's talk about what you have prepared for the opening at the Canvas on Friday night.
Well, it's very different from Fumi's work. Mine starts out with used books, almost all of which came from Friends of the Library, which, incidentally, I'm donating whatever sells. I'll be giving 50% of the profits to Friends of the Library out of appreciation in many ways. And anyone who's been out there realizes that's where books go to die and hopefully have another life. And that's really what I've been doing with them, is giving them a new life.
So why don't you describe what it is exactly that you do?
All right. I usually start with a hard cover book, and I start with either what the book looks like. I'm going to backtrack a minute and say I'm a reader, and I don't enjoy it as much if I do it on a Kindle. I have done it, but I love the feel of the pages. I love the way they turn. I like the way the font looks on the page. All of those things I really love. So what I'm doing here is starting with either the content of the book, what the book is about, or starting with the way the book actually looks and feels, and then trying to reimagine the book as a three-dimensional other object. Does that make any sense?
Yes, you're creating sculptures out of
really.
These books.
Yes.
Yes.
And I do that by folding them or tearing them. I usually don't use glue to keep them together in their new form. Maybe a little happens from time to time. I take the covers off for the main part. I'll use scissors. It just depends on what the book wants
inspires
me to do with it.
Uh-huh. So you, when you're choosing,
yes,
you specifically will create something based,
yes,
on what the contents of that book is?
For example, there are quite a few dictionaries or encyclopedias. Those are always free at Friends of the Library. Nobody keeps old ones. But those are so much about, you know, these little words and these papers, thin paper, and a quantity, right? Lots of words, lots of pages. So I have spent a lot of time folding them into sections, depending on, you know, is it an A, a B, a C, or ripping the pages to make them sort of reveal against that movement through the book. I don't know.
Yeah,
hard
so
to
and
describe.
Just in seeing some of the images of,
yes,
what you've created, there are these three-dimensional sculptures. As you've described, some of the pages are folded in some to create sort of geometric forms. Others, I see that you've curled the pages and made,
yes,
almost
and
like flower petals.
Yes, some of those look almost like flowers from,
yes,
above. If the edges of the book are gold or have some sort of color happening with them, you can look into the book when you curl the edges, and they really make beautiful forms.
So this is a very unusual art form. How did you start working in this capacity?
You know, it's not an art form you run into a lot, but I've been aware of it for at least 3 years now when my sister-in-law taught me a very simple fold that transformed my relationship to used books. And then I started to look online and realized this is really, there are a lot of artists working in quite different ways with books. My particular bent, as I said, comes from the book itself, but people do all kinds of things with them.
Well, both shows look to be wonderful. You are both presenting at the Canvas this Friday. What time does the opening start?
4:30.
Okay. Oh, there you go. I had you off mic. At 4:30 at the Canvas, Fumi Matsumoto with her prints on tea bags and khaki shields. You've done some amazing work creating art sculptures out of books that otherwise maybe would have gone to the dump. So I like the recycling trend with both of you and the art that you've done. And real quick, Fumi, you also have some art that people can go see at the City Museum right now?
Oh, yeah. The Empty Chair exhibit is up there through, I think, October. I'm not sure exactly when, maybe first couple of weeks of mid-October, and it's about the Japanese internment and the families that were in Juneau who had been forcibly removed, and many of you might have been to or heard about the memorial chair, the empty chair that's now here in Juneau at it's the park near Capitol School. And the pieces that I have seven pieces, artwork that are mixed media that reflect the internment. And so it's really sort of interesting. It's totally different than my tea bags, of course. But we love it if you could go and see the show.
Okay, yes. And
I want to say one thing about that show, which is quite striking. It's also about Juneau's reaction to the internment of the Japanese citizens here, and the community really seemed to be very supportive of people as being part of the community in large part, and the show does explain a little bit about that too.
Yeah, there's a long story, and I know you don't have enough time, but the empty chair, what is the empty chair? So go see the show and find out about it.
Yeah, so that's happening at the City Museum downtown, and then you both have this art opening coming up at the Canvas on Friday night. Fumi Matsumoto, Khaki Shields, thank you so much for joining us today on a Juneau Afternoon.
Thanks for having us, Cheryl.
Thank you.
Listening to the group Break From Reality with their song Star. This is Cheryl Snyder. The time is 3:23 in the afternoon. I am joined in the studio now by Davida Stipek Reiter. She is the featured artist at the Juneau Artist Gallery on Friday night for First Friday. She's a landscape painter, and she's here to tell us a little bit about what her show is about. Welcome, Davida. So here we go. Got you on mic now. Okay, so why don't you tell us about what you've created for this show?
I have about a dozen paintings
It'll be at JAG, the Juno Artists Gallery. And I'm a new member of the gallery. There's about 24 of us, I believe. And I'm looking forward to this show coming up. So,
where did you do most of your landscapes for this show?
They're mostly the Juno area. There's only about maybe one that isn't local.
And where in Juno? Where did you find inspiration?
Well, I live on Horse Island, so a lot of my paintings are that, you know, views from the island, looking down the channel at other islands, and with the mountains and the sea and that sort of thing. I do have some. I have one of on North Douglas at Shaman Island, and then I have looking down Gastineau Channel from under the bridge. And I'm trying to think now real quick.
Yeah, and I think this gives us a good sense. You've kind of been all around town and find some nice spots. So when you're looking at a landscape, what sorts of things catch your attention and make you want to go get your paintbrush and your canvas?
Well, I love drama, so I look for a lot of contrast and color, of course. You know, the sunsets are spectacular, of course, in this area. And, of course, they've been a little bit on the slim side this summer, you know. Sometimes I imagine the color because I've seen enough of them if I'm not getting enough in it. But what I like to do, I like drama, like I said. So I look for shapes, and I look for color, and I look for texture, I look for contrast, dark and light, shadows, sunlight, you know, that sort of thing.
And how would you describe your paintings? Would you say that they're realistic paintings, but also with other influences?
Right. Realism is a broad picture, you know. It can go anywhere from super realism to more abstract. And mine is a little bit towards the abstract, because I could take a camera and copy a scene that I see with that, if that's what I was looking for. I try to put part of myself in my painting. I respond to my environment, the weather, the feeling I get from what I see. So there's more to it than just what I see.
And how often are you actually painting in the environment versus painting inside a studio?
Oh, I mostly paint outdoors, but, you know, as the weather permits.
Mm-hmm. So, and do you have a way to stay covered if it starts to rain? Do you have umbrellas and things that you pull out?
Right. Yeah. And I also take pictures of scenery, so I have something like 20,000 photographs that I've taken myself on my hard drive, and then I can project a favorite photograph on the wall and pretend like I'm outdoors. So I've done that.
Mm. Now, what's the size or the scale of the paintings that you're doing? Are you painting very small? Are you working on a very large scale?
No, they tend to be small. I have as small as 5x7, as large as 10x18, that sort of thing.
Okay. And you work in both oils and in acrylic, is that right?
I do, but all of these are oil paints. Mm-hmm. Oil paintings.
Okay.
Right.
Anything else you'd like to share about the show on Friday?
Well, it's from 4:30 to 8, and the JAG, Juno Artists Gallery, is on South Franklin at, I believe it's 214 at the Senate.
Yeah, I think the Senate building is a good landmark. People you can just go in there and check it out.
And we'll have refreshments. And so just come on by and see my work and see the other artists' work there. We'll just have a nice time.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Thanks so much, Davida, for coming in and sharing about your paintings. I'm sure it's going to be a beautiful show.
Well, thank you.
Okay,
thank
have
you
a lovely afternoon.
Me. Yep. And bye. Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 30th of July, 2014. It was on this day, 1965, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Social Security Act, which created the Medicare and Medicaid programs, country's first national health insurance law. It's the birthday of the blues guitarist Buddy Guy, born Letsworth, Louisiana, 1936, made his own guitar when he was 13, learned to play listening to the records of John Lee Hooker and others, started playing clubs in Baton Rouge, moved to Chicago in 1957. He was just 21 years old, and that's where Muddy Waters discovered him and took him under his wing. He was very popular in the 60s. He was a sideman for Howlin' Wolf, Little Walter, Coco Taylor. Eric Clapton said, "Buddy Guy was to me what Elvis was for others." But it bothered Buddy Guy that rock and roll stations would play an Eric Clapton version of a Muddy Waters song, but they would not play Muddy Waters himself. It was on this day in 1975 in Bloomfield Township, Michigan, near Detroit, that Teamsters leader Jimmy Hoffa disappeared. He'd been involved with the Teamsters from 1932 to 1975, been its president. He'd had ties to organized crime, went to jail. President Nixon commuted his sentence. And on this day in 1975, Hoffa told his friends he was going to meet with two mafia leaders at the Red Fox restaurant in Bloomfield Township. Police found his car hours later in the parking lot. No sign of Hoffa. His body has never been found. And it's the birthday of Emily Bronte, born Yorkshire, England, 1818, daughter of a clergyman, sister of Anne and Charlotte Bronte. Mother died of cancer when they were small children. Their father was a quiet, solitary man, spent much of his time in his room. And so the children learned to entertain themselves. They made up stories, made up a whole imaginary land, Angria. And when she was 29, Emily wrote Wuthering Heights. Here's a poem for today by Erica Jong, a poem entitled The Raspberries in My Driveway, with an inscription, a quote from Thoreau, "Nature will bear the closest inspection. She invites us to lay our eyes level with her smallest leaf and take an insect view of its plane." The raspberries in my driveway have always been here for the whole 11 years I have owned but have not owned this house. Yet I have never tasted them before. Always on a plane, always in the arms of man, not God, always too busy, too fretful, too worried to see that all along my driveway are red, red raspberries for me to taste. Shiny and red, without hairs, unlike the berries from the market, little jewels, I share them with the birds. On one perches a tiny green insect. I blow her off. She flies. I burst the raspberry upon my tongue. In my solitude, I commune with raspberries, with grasses, with the world. The world was always there before, but where was I? Ah, raspberry, if you are so beautiful, upon my ready tongue, imagine what wonders lie in store for me. A poem by Erica Jong, The Raspberries in My Driveway, from her collection Becoming Light, published by Harper Perennial, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
You are listening to KTOO in Juneau at 104.3, where the time is 3:34. My next guest today on a Juneau afternoon is Dave Smith, a naturalist who has worked in Yellowstone, Glacier, Denali, and Glacier Bay National Parks. He's the author of several books on bears and how to be safe in bear country. Dave is in Juneau just for today as a visitor off of one of the cruise ships, and he's here to talk to us about bear spray, firearms, and making smart choices in bear country. So welcome, Dave.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Why don't we start with having you just give a little bit of your background and how you got to the point that you know so much about bears and bear behavior?
Well, I started working in Yellowstone National Park back in the 70s, and it just gave me an opportunity to see bears and to observe bear behavior. And what I realized is that everything I was observing was different than everything I had ever heard or read about bears. Bears have poor vision, for example. Well, I saw bears behave in ways that I knew they didn't have poor vision. So once I got that idea in my head, I just tried to throw out everything I'd heard or read and look at it from a neutral standpoint and got out among bears as much as I could, studied them, and tried to learn about them.
So you've written several books on bears and being safe in bear country. One of the issues that has become very important to you is helping people who are out in the wilderness understand when it's the appropriate time to use bear spray and when a firearm is the best option. And let's just say, you know, first as a base here, most of us are never going to be in a confrontation with a bear in the wilderness that would require us to defend ourselves in that way. But, you know, worst case scenario, we always want to be prepared for that. So what are some of your thoughts and recommendations on this?
Well, the first thing, if anybody has to make a choice between bear spray or a firearm, is ask yourself, do I own a firearm? Am I comfortable with firearms? Do I hate firearms? They scare me. And if that's the answer, bear spray is your obvious choice. Hunters, particularly people who go after moose, caribou, or in the lower 48 where people are hunting elk, if you're using a rifle, you have no choice but to use that rifle. When you come into a situation where you have a sudden encounter with a bear, it charges, everything happens in a heartbeat. You've got to react now.
So, and do you have recommendations for hunters how they can train themselves to be prepared for that event? It's very different to react to an animal that's charging at you versus setting your sights on an animal that's still in the bushes.
Yes. Step one would be don't sling a rifle over your shoulder, because if you do, it takes a couple seconds to get it into action. I've always said that slings have saved more game animals than PETA. So first of all, you're going to miss shots at moose, caribou, and other animals you're hunting for. But second, if you get into a sudden encounter with a grizzly or another bear, you won't have a chance to use that rifle. So if you don't sling it, you'll have it in your hands, and you can get ready to shoot much, much faster.
Mm-hmm. And what about people who a firearm, for any number of reasons, isn't with them or it's not an option for them, and they do opt to carry bear spray with them? What sort of recommendations do you have around effectively using bear spray?
Well, with bear spray, you've got very, very limited range, about 30 feet or less, and that's only if it's not windy and in pretty warm temperatures. The colder it gets, it's got an aerosol propellant, and so it starts to lose range and effectiveness. So I think the key for most hikers is carry it in your hand. People think that if they've got it in a little hip holster, on a carabiner attached to a pack strap, that they've got quick access to it. Wrong. There have been a lot of cases where people carrying bear spray that way surprised a nearby bear. It charged. They didn't have time to use their spray, and they ended up in a hospital as a result.
Mm. And is there anything that someone who has neither bear spray or a firearm with them, is there anything they can do if they are caught in this circumstance of being attacked by a bear?
Well, years ago, I was reading a book, and it said if you get in that exact situation, lay down, curl up, and think of Jesus. But really, your best option is to simply stand and hold your ground. And, of course, that's easier said than done. But if you try to retreat and slowly back away, whether you've got a curious bear or aggressive bear, that just encourages the bear to come forward. Whereas if you stand your ground, what your body language is telling the bear is, I'm here, I'm willing to fight. If you touch me, it's going to cost you. You know that's not true, but the bear might not.
So we're hitting on sort of worst-case scenarios. There's lots that we can do when being in bear country. Juneau is a prime example. We've got bears walking down our main street. Many of us are out in the wilderness. So what are some of the things that we can do to make sure that our encounters are happy ones and safe ones?
Well, I'm sure everybody's heard about keep your food stored properly. That's more of a town issue, and I think when people go backpacking and hiking on overnight trips or kayaking, everyone's pretty conscientious about food because you have to be. Otherwise, you're just giving a bear a written invitation to come and raid your camp. Other than that, it's true that there's safety in numbers, but the key thing to remember if you have a group of people is you have to stay together. There's been a number of instances where people are in a large group, but you tend to get strung out. And when that happens, you can just imagine the first person comes around a blind corner on a trail, goes over the top of a hill, and a bear just sees one person. You've lost all the advantages of being with a group.
Okay, so safety with food, staying in a group, standing your ground, not backing away if you see a bear. Any other things that you can think of?
Well, number one on my list is always to pay attention. I try not to be in a hurry or anything, and just pay attention because a lot of the time you can detect a bear before it ever detects you. And then the second thing is to make noise when it's appropriate. And some people tell you to sing and shout and carry on a constant conversation, and I can't imagine doing that because what's the point of being out in a hike in the woods in the wilderness if you're making a huge racket and scaring away bears and all the other animals? So what I do is your hands are usually empty or whatever. You can clap your hands and make noise. The other thing is I just carry a stick, like a walking stick, and periodically whap it against a tree trunk, a branch, something like that. The sound carries far, and it's an alarming sound to a bear. Human voices, sometimes they don't get that alarmed, but that stick breaking, it could be anything out there, and so they're on alert when you do that.
So, and you said to make noise when appropriate, and it's funny because I was just talking with someone yesterday about that. I know that with my bear encounters, I don't always, when I see a bear, let them know that I'm there. If I think they are aware of me, that's when I let them know I'm there. If I feel like I can get away without them knowing I'm there, I will not make noise, and I don't know if that's smart. What would be your recommendation around that?
No, that's exactly the right thing to do. Just keep your eye on the bear, keep facing it, and if it's not aware of you, if it hasn't heard you, the last thing you'd want to do, I mean, there's people out there doing jumping jacks and going, hey, bear, hey, bear. The bear looks up and says, what is that thing doing over there? So, no, if you can get away sight unseen, that's by far the best thing to do, is to increase that distance between you.
Okay, great. Thanks, Dave Smith. Now, you have written several books on the subject. Are there any that you would recommend to our audience as a good go-to just to learn the basics of bear safety or to delve a little further into the notion of bear spray versus firearm?
Backcountry Bear Basics. That book's got a lot of information about bear behavior, and it'll give people the knowledge to see what an encounter looks like from the bear's point of view. And that's, you're responding, you're reacting appropriately to that.
Okay, great. And you can also get information on the website of the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. They do have a page listing recommendations on how you can avoid bear encounters. So information is out there. It's good for all of us to educate ourselves. Dave Smith, thanks so much for coming in and joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Cheryl.
We hope you have a wonderful rest of your trip through Alaska.
I will.
Bears in the city. city, wearing trench coats. You gotta look closely, they're blending in so well with the crowd. They dress like the mayor, or a mailman, or a housewife. Riding skateboards, wearing sunglasses in front of eyes. It's nature in disguise. Bears in the cafes, it's new and intellectual. They're crossing new frontiers of mind. Leave that messy muskeg behind. It's like some kind of strange experiment. It's also stimulating. Bears on the freeways, trading hot dogs, feeling wild, feeling free, energized by speed, wind in their fur like never before, never again to hunt on all fours. This is the good life. This is the good life. This is the good life. The bad bears slouching under streetlights. They're watching naked legs pass by, growling out. Hey, honey.
Yeah. Hey, dear.
Hey, hoof it on over here.
Mind my paws.
Hey, nice coat. Can you bear any chain? But me, I don't talk to back bears. I just keep on walking. Bears on your back porch, digging in your garbage. You thought they'd socialize me on that point, and they can't really be starving. You call out welfare.
Hello.
You say,
I'd like to report some bears in my garbage.
Hello.
Bear welfare. No. Don't put me on hold. No,
hello.
This is not a dog. It's a
hello
bear.
What about these bears?
About 3 o'clock this afternoon.
My dog.
Doesn't anybody
care?
I have my watch on.
Are you listening to me?
Hello? No, don't put me on hold.
What about these homeless bears?
Hello? Are you listening to me? Hello?
Doesn't anybody care? Doesn't anybody care?
Are you there?
Doesn't
hello?
Anybody care?
Hello?
Doesn't anybody
hello?
We're listening to Babes with Axes, the song Bears in the City. This is Cheryl Snyder. The time is 3:48 in the afternoon. You are tuned to KTOO in Juneau. And our final guests today on a Juneau afternoon are Rebecca Friedlander and Kristen Price. They are here to share with us about an event on Friday at Chapel by the Lake featuring pottery, stories, and music. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Kristen, why don't you just start and explain a little bit what the event is, and then Rebecca will go to you and you can really describe what it is that you do.
Sure. Well, we have Rebecca Friedlander. She's a crazy talented lady that has visited a couple times. She's from recently, I guess, transplanted from Texas to Nashville, and she's here to do an event that is going to involve some music and some making of pottery and telling a story along with that. And I'm so excited about it because I think it's just going to be a very moving, powerful event. And so we'll just let Rebecca tell you about the rest of it.
Yeah. Why don't you describe exactly what it is that you do?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. It's kind of an experience you have to come and enjoy. But I'll give you the nutshell version. I found that life made sense to me when I started viewing it through the perspective of the potter and the clay, and through what Scripture says about how God is the potter and we're the clay. And so I started looking at the pottery process, because I'd been doing pottery for a little while, and thinking, wow, every one of these steps is so familiar because I've experienced them in my life and what I go through in my own journey. So I just started, I did some writing and wrote a book about it, and then I just started sharing that with people and found that it resonated with them as well. So the event Friday night will be me with my potter's wheel, sharing the story as I'm making a piece on the wheel, and then also doing some music that I've written along with it.
Okay, now I've had the advantage of seeing a video of you describing what it is you do and sort of doing a little bit. So maybe just kind of pulling from what I had the chance to see, you can describe a little bit more as you're creating the piece, the ways that you are moving and molding and shaping the clay, you are relating to life experiences and God's influence on all of us. Is that a fair description?
Yeah. For instance, a couple examples. One, if you've ever worked with pottery, or if anybody ever has, you know that it can be kind of frustrating because it starts to wobble, and it's that whole centering process. And when I was first starting, my clay would wobble and even fly off the potter's wheel. And I talked to a friend of mine, and she said, she's kind of coaching me. And I said, how will I know when the clay is centered? And she said, oh, you'll know. Because when it's centered, potters say the clay is at rest in the potter's hands. And that's when it stops wobbling. And literally, you can feel it when your hands are over that clay. It becomes perfectly still, still moving, but it's still. And that describes the point in our lives where we can be just trying to do our own thing and make life work and make things happen. But when we surrender to the potter, he brings us to a place of stillness and peace that we can't find any other way. And it doesn't mean that we see the finished product yet, but it means that God can make us into what he wants us to be. So that's an example of one of the steps.
Mm-hmm. I think you also had a really nice sort of poetic, another example of that was as you're creating something and it kind of crumbled and fell and needing to kind of piece it back together.
Yeah.
And sort of as you've described. Yeah. So yeah. Who is the audience for this sort of event? Is it adults? Is it children? Is it men? Is it women?
Everyone. I've spoken in the past 10 or 11 years, I've spoken to groups probably 5-6 years and up. And so anyone who, it's kind of interactive. It's neat to be able to watch a visual. It's not so much like a sermon, because even though I am speaking and sharing from Scripture, you get to watch a potter work. And so people of any age love to do that.
And the pieces that you create, do you do something with them, or do they get folded back into your mound of clay to be reshaped another time?
Yeah, they get recycled.
That's great. So you create this pottery, you're telling stories, and sounds like, as we've already described, the music that goes along with it, this is your own music mm-hmm. that you've written?
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I started out just even as a teenager really loving Christian music and wanting to be the artist and do that whole thing, and came to a point where I just felt like doors weren't opening, so I just shelved the whole thing. And when it came back around, it was so much more meaningful. I felt like I could share my heart and express my heart in a way that wasn't just me talking as an artist, but I actually write for other people in a way that could maybe express some of their story or impact them in a personal way. So some of the music that I'll be sharing is from a CD that was just released called Transform. And it talks about the journey. There's a song that goes with every one of the steps of the potter's wheel process. And so it kind of brings those things to life from kind of a heart perspective.
So yeah. You travel all over the country doing this sort of presentation to groups. Where else have you been?
Well, I just got back from Illinois. I was out there doing several churches in California and just kind of all over the place, yeah.
And this is just one of several projects that you have your hand in. Maybe you can talk about some of the other things you've been doing, including your work with the Zahasky family here that many of us know so well.
Yes. I did two projects last year, and one of them was with the Alaska String Band, whom a lot of you guys know so well. They're wonderful people, very dear people. And last year I was up here and ended up doing a film for them, because I do video production as well. So I had my cameras, and we just went for it to capture their production on film.
Great. And what other projects are you working on?
Well, I finished a TV series and a film last year called Pioneers. I grew up with Christian music, and my parents listened to music from the 70s and the early 80s, the whole Jesus movement, all the hippies who were doing music back then, you know, and some of them really had, they were foundational to Christian music. They kind of started the whole ball rolling with modern contemporary music. And so I thought, wouldn't it be cool to find maybe 12 of these people and sit down and interview them and get their perspective and their advice for the next generation? And so I just had a bunch of my young artist friends and was sat down with them and was like, if you could ask a veteran artist anything, what would it be? And then I took their questions to 12 of these pioneers all across the country and sat with them in their living rooms and just met with these incredible people who've been doing music for 40 years or so, and asked them to speak into the lives of young people, and they did.
And all of this content, people can watch it through what venues? Can you access it, any of it online, or is it over-the-air channels?
Yes. There are several television stations that air it, but you can also purchase it on my website. And you can go there. I think Pioneers is kind of all over the place right now, so you can find that on Amazon and things like that as well. But you can find everything on my website, too.
Okay, terrific. Yeah. So you've got your Friday night booked. You're doing this presentation to a group of folks at the Chapel by the Lake. Are you going to be here through the weekend to enjoy the Juno, or are you going to be off to your next event?
Yeah, I'm here for a couple of weeks, actually. So I am super excited about just being here and soaking in some more Juno. Juno air is amazing.
Terrific. Is there anything else you'd like to share with folks about what they can expect on Friday and you know, anything else you'd like people to know?
Oh, I think when I share, I don't think it's so much just coming to see an artist. I think it ends up being about the audience. And I really want people to be able to come and just listen and take something home with them that impacts their lives. And I've done this enough, and God has been gracious enough to be able to watch that happen with people. Yeah.
Okay, Rebecca Friedlander, you're going to be performing at 7 o'clock at Chapel by the Lake, Pottery, Stories, and Music. And we are going to close out with one of your songs. Can you tell us a little bit about the track that you chose for us to play?
Yeah, it's about not being perfect, but about how God loves us in the process anyway.
Okay, perfect. Thank you, Rebecca, and thank you, Kristen Price, for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Potter loved the clay, every step along the way, and when it's a mess, he loves what he's not finished yet. Turning upon the wheel brings back around my lofty ideals, and if I can't be perfect, better to scratch the whole plan completely. But someone once said, the potter loves the clay every step along the way, even when it's a mess, he loves what he's not finished yet. And butterfly wings, and maybe my faith in the smallest of steps pleases his heart, though I'm not perfect yet. 'Cause someone once said, the potter loved the clay every step along the way, even when it's a mess, he loves what he's not finished yet. Slowly, slowly, I'm starting to
This is KTOO in Juneau. We broadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Ock Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on DCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you. We're coming up onto All Things Considered here in just a few moments. If you missed any of today's A Juneau Afternoon or would just like to hear it again, you can go to our website where we will post the audio of the program. Thanks so much to each of our guests for coming down here and talking with us today, and thanks to you for listening.